Welcome back to the second hour of Leading Edge Medicine. Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only.
Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with your host, Pete Talbot, along with Dr. Samara Humat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you an opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here's your host of Leading Edge Medicine, Pete Talbot.
And here we go for hour number four. Well, hour number two here on 570 KVI, but hour number four
for us.
Hour number four for us. And again, if you want to know where we are for all 4 hours every Saturday morning, simply go to our website, lmclinic.com, push on the little podcast button at the top of the page, and it will list out every hour where we are. But even more importantly, it hit me this morning. I need to tell you, you hear a lot of stuff on this program. And I know you're thinking, because I do it all the time, oh, my cousin needs to see this or hear this. Oh, my friend at work. Oh, my uncle. Oh, whatever. Well, all of our shows are on our website, lmclinic.com. By pushing the podcast button, it brings them all up. They're all on there chronologically. I was going to say geographically, but that probably wouldn't help us much. Chronologically. And hour by hour by hour, 4 hours every Saturday. So just remember, oh, I heard Dr. Umat say this. Oh, I heard Dr. Mixon say that. Mark the time on your watch, and it's this hour, that hour, this hour, whatever. And tell your friends, tell your parents, tell your kids. It's a smart thing to do, or maybe you just want to hear it again yourself. lmclinic.com. Push the podcast button, and boom, there it is. You know, I was just for a little moment bummed out here about 3 minutes ago. You want to know why?
Why?
During the top of the hour break, my computer alerted me. I'm supposed to be getting off the cruise ship in Rome today. We were going to be on a 2-week cruise to, you know, Ephesus, Greece, Budapest, starting in Rome, ending in Rome. We're getting off today.
Oh, well. The reality is, if you were on a cruise ship, you might not get off.
Yeah. Hey, they're starting up again, though.
I understand. Yeah. And I'm not getting
Are
on.
They? Really?
Yeah. Carnival and others. Okay. Yeah, we'll be cruising again. We love to cruise. It's especially.
But I want my vaccine first.
Yes. Yeah. It'll be a year or two before we cruise again. But anyway, sorry for that little side note, but it was kind of a bummer, you know.
Well, you know, it depends on where you are. In order to have herd immunity so that you cannot get an epidemic, you need about 70% of the population to have antibodies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There was a study about 2 or 3 weeks ago that up in Lombardy in Italy, the area that got hit so hard, 53% of the population is antibody positive.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's the good side.
Yeah. So most of the people in the Lombardy region of Italy have already had the disease. Most of them didn't know it because they were asymptomatic, but they are antibody positive, which goes to our discussion earlier
about
asymptomatic people.
Yeah.
You know, do they carry antibody or how fast does it wane? Well, at least in the strain they had in Italy, 53% of the population in that region is all antibody positive, which means that they haven't really hit herd immunity, but knowing that half the people can't catch the disease means if it spreads, it'll spread much slower. and they won't get these giant logarithmic peaks.
Sure. And then we don't know about mutation of the virus either. Interesting, because the study published here on Medscape said that if you don't have symptoms, then the IgG antibody will not be positive for long, only for 8 weeks.
Right. But I don't know which antibody. I have to go back and look at that study to see which antibody they were testing. Were they looking at M or G?
G.
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
Don't look at me, guys. Don't look at me. That's all right.
All right.
Okay. Interesting stuff. Shall we take some more calls?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Let's go to Bellevue. Talk to Kathy. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, I am a UW patient with multiple issues, and I would like an opinion on a couple things, if you have time to answer briefly. Let's see, I'm 78 years old, and the immediate situation is I've had a toenail infection. I guess it's called a fungal thing, and maybe athlete's feet also, and it's just been, I've not treated it particularly properly at all. And so, let's see, I scheduled tentatively without any research. I'm sorry, I'm going to lose my voice maybe. Is a toenail removal of both the little toe on my left foot and my large toe. And do you have much knowledge on toenail removal? Any negatives on that or anything you care to share?
You know, back in my country doctor days, I took out I removed a whole lot of toenails.
They grow back.
You said what?
Back in my country doctor days, I removed a lot of toenails. Yes.
Seriously, really?
Oh, absolutely, sure.
Why did you remove toenails?
Well, you know, in those days, we did not have very good antifungal agents for toenails.
Okay,
but there are some pretty good drugs now, and these are the same drugs you would use orally, except you just apply them to the base of the nail, and you have to do it for 6 months to a year, though. Because what happens is toenails grow very slowly, and the drugs do not penetrate that hard cartilaginous nail very well. So what you do is you put it right at the cuticle, right at the base of where the nail is starting to grow out, and you let it penetrate there. You get the drug in there so that it kills the fungus in the new nail as it grows out. But you have to continue using it as the whole nail grows out, and you cut off the old nail and throw it away, obviously, as it grows out. So because toenails grow so slow, and especially they grow very slow in old people, you may be looking at putting something on your nail every day for the next year. But eventually it tends to work. Now, removing a nail is a whole lot faster. You know, I can go in, put a needle in, block off all four of those digital nerves, and just slide a pair of scissors underneath the nails, separate it, pull it off, throw it away. Now you've got a fresh, raw nail bed. And it will be tender for several days. So, you know, you're going to need to protect it while it heals.
Well, the doctor's saying one to three weeks possibly of recovery, and
Removing the nails is a 10-minute job.
Exactly, and it's like I'm not even totally sure if my insurance and my supplement as a Medicare patient cover the entire thing. My podiatrist does not consider it a surgery. He said we do it on an office visit, and he has his own surgery day. Mm-hmm. And for some reason I didn't do any research. I asked a couple people, and they said they knew nothing about it. I guess I discussed it a couple of years ago when I became a first patient. And he said that, you know, the nail is it's going to be skin color. The nail is gone. And I told him that a long time ago, many years ago, actually 50 years ago, believe it or not, I was on an international trip, and I carried with me this nail remover, polish remover or something, and I never used it there. I brought it home. This is in 1969. I did a 2-month trip, And I used it, and immediately all my fingernails just dissolved. They just came off. I couldn't believe it. It was shocking.
Oh, my goodness.
And, yeah, I'm serious. In fact, I think I told this doctor that I believe even when I was younger, maybe even fourth grade possibly, that for some reason I was at the window in the classroom, and I touched the window, and it came down on top of my fingernails, whatever, and I think – I don't know if anything happened there, but it was so shocking on this trip, a Europe trip, 2 month trip, and came back and I didn't, you know, I took this powdered remover off and I thought, oh my gosh. And it was very sad. And it was, I put bandages, I mean, but anyway, so of course they want to do, you know, the easy thing is just give someone a pill or whatever and that's
sure.
it, but you're telling me. And in fact, he told me, I just saw him on Friday, actually, yesterday, I guess, and he said that, well, let's see, I'm trying to think what some of his words were. He said, well, you know, we talked about this a couple of years ago. I said, yes, I knew nothing about removal. He said, go ahead. So is your comment that if you want to go to the nail remover process, it's okay.
It's fast. It's easy. Although it does make you kind of miserable for, you know, a week or two while you're healing up. I mean, you're going to have a raw surface there. Also, remember, you've already got fungus growing on your feet, and there's no guarantee that as the new nail grows in, it won't have fungus in it too. So, you know, So we can't guarantee that whatever new nail grows won't also have fungus. My personal inclination would be to have the compounding pharmacist make you up a antifungal, something like itraconazole, and you just put a few drops on the top of that nail and rub it in each day for, you know, however long it takes. And as your nail grows out, it should be fungus-free.
And with that, I'm afraid I've got to pull things to a close because we're going to a break. We got to do a break every 15 minutes.
Thank you for the call.
Yes. Thank you, Kathy. Good luck with that. I know toenail fungus is a frustrating problem for a lot of people, so that's a good idea. All right. When we come back, we've got a question from Maury Island. Not sure where that is. Maury Island, M-O-R-R-Y Island. Armin wants to know about a rotator cuff and DMSO. But then we got questions about omega-3 and muscle pain. Another question about DMSO. Oh, my golly, this is just cooking here. And the garlic and what to do about the garlic smell. Anyway, lots of reason. Yeah, right. No comment. We'll be right back. Don't go far.
I definitely would recommend that people attend a seminar. It was a great overview of what he does, but the real results are in the program, and that speaks for itself. The results came almost immediately, and they've been getting better and better.
Two people dancing here in the studio.
Why aren't you dancing?
Well, I'm sitting down doing my job.
Stand. Nobody will notice.
I'm just happy. I'm happy right here. Thank you very much. Don't hang up. Armin, David, Sue, and Lillian are all on hold, so don't hang up. We're going to get to you soon enough. In fact, let's go to Armin right now. Armin, welcome to Leading Edge Medicine.
Hello, Armin.
Hello, Dr. and Pete. So first, Maury is spelled M as in Mary, A-U-R-Y, and it's connected to Vashon Island by an isthmus or a land.
Oh, good to know. Okay, good to know. Thanks for that.
So I heard David talking about DMSO, which I had heard of, but I wasn't sure what it was, and it piqued my interest because I have a right shoulder rotator cuff issue going on. I had this 2 years ago. Had physical therapy for about 3 months, and I was back to normal. I guess it was a slight tear in one of the four rotator cuff muscles or tendons or whatever those things are. It was the supraspinatus, and it flared up again about 6 months or so ago. And I'm an amateur violinist, and the problem is right at the level that my right hand or right arm, which is the bow arm, is when I'm playing the violin. So I really can't play. Otherwise, I can work around it. And so I went back to physical therapy. And when I went through this 2 years ago, besides doing exercises and so on, stretching exercises, the physical therapist in a 45-minute session once a week would do the ultrasound treatment, which got the blood flow going, I guess, and then would do a bunch of massage and so on to stretch the muscles. Anyway, I had one physical therapy session about 3 months ago, and then we had the whole COVID lockdown. So mm-hmm. I've been doing the home exercises, but they're barely doing anything. And I feel like I need to have the work done that I can't have done because of the lockdown. Then I heard the thing about the DMSO, and I wondered if nothing else, I have the characteristic of pain at night when you're lying horizontally, and mm-hmm. whether that DMSO might provide some relief. That's my question.
It will probably provide relief, symptomatic relief. You know, it will decrease the inflammation in the joint and the ligaments. It will suppress pain, so the nociceptors won't be sending the bad signals to your brain, so you'll feel better. It doesn't do anything to heal the problem, all right? So the underlying pathology will still be there, but you'll be more comfortable.
Sure. And taking ibuprofen doesn't do anything but relieve the pain either. But so would that
precisely
be less effect than taking ibuprofen?
Well, the DMSO will decrease the actual inflammatory changes in the joint and the ligaments, whereas the ibuprofen doesn't. Okay. The ibuprofen is strictly, it is an anti-inflammatory, but it's pretty darn weak when it comes to muscles and ligaments. It's a better analgesic in that preventing you from perceiving the pain, but it's not a very good anti-inflammatory really. You got to remember with the ibuprofen, you're taking anywhere from 2 to 800 milligrams of it, and diluting it through your entire body mass. So the amount that is actually in those ligaments and joints are really tiny. Okay. Whereas the DMSO is going directly where the inflammation is.
But again, this is just classic why you might want to consider Dr. Dan Nelson, because he can go in there through x-rays and MRIs, whatever's necessary, and determine what maybe can actually solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, if he can find the specific ligament that is being damaged, and if he can put, you know, a stem cell PRP slurry right along the surface of that ligament, you may trigger enough healing and repair to fix the problem.
Yeah.
So.
So for now, I go to the pharmacy and I get some DMSO?
Well, yeah. You can order it online. It's an over-the-counter sort of thing. It's not a prescription drug.
Oh.
And that's because it's not approved by the FDA for any human use. All right. Veterinarians use it. Animal trainers use it. It's used on racehorses and cattle and all sorts of things. But it is not approved by the FDA for any human use. So if you buy it and you use it, you are taking your own risks. Nobody's guaranteed diddly squat. No one's approved it. This is one of those things that this stuff was actually discovered in the 1800s in Germany. All right. It has been used and passed down from grandma to grandma. And, you know, people that deal with horses and cattle and stuff have used it on their animals. And then when it helps the animals, the ranchers use it on themselves. Very few doctors actually discuss DMSO. The only reason I discussed it is because I was specifically asked about it.
Yeah.
Compounding pharmacists do use it to drive more complex molecules through the skin into the system. For instance, once in a while, you know, we use a lot of testosterone cream in our patients, male and female. Once in a while, you get somebody that just doesn't absorb the drug well. They have a skin that is relatively impermeable to the hormone, and the compounding pharmacist will add a little DMSO to the cream, and it drives that testosterone right through the skin and raises blood levels more efficiently. So that's about the only time we actually use it in our clinic, is having the compounding pharmacist use it in a compound.
Okay. I think you answered another question that occurred to me to ask, which was why the physician I originally saw to be screened and get the referral, this was with Kaiser Permanente, to get the referral to physical therapy, they act as a gatekeeper, nor the physical therapist ever mentioned the DMSO. And maybe it's because, as you say, it's not approved for that use, so they're not going to put that out there and take any
Precisely. If the doctor is writing prescriptions for a drug that is not approved for human use, only for veterinary use, and you report any sort of adverse effect, his malpractice company will be really pissy about the situation. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, and again, I could go to any grocery store, and they might have it in the aisle with other.
They might. I know you can find it on Amazon and so on. I don't think you'd find it in over-the-counter in the drugstore. Yeah. You'd find it in feed stores and farm supply stores, and they sell it by the quart. All right.
And you betcha.
Take care.
Thanks, Armin. Let's go to Woodinville and talk with David. Hello, David. Welcome to Leading Edge Medicine.
Hi. How are you doing today? You have a wonderful program going on.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Hey, I had a couple of things maybe helpful, but then I wanted to get on to the most important thing. But my wife uses DMSO and aloe vera with great, great success, so I wanted to mention that. The next thing was on the metformin extended release. Last week you talked about that was your kind of your first drug of preference until this recall. I take the thousands, and I talked with my pharmacist last week, and it's not on the recall at all. And I guess there's like a zillion different sources that the 500 and their 750s were recalled, but not the thousands. So I just wanted to add that, if that's any help.
All right.
And the most important thing I wanted to ask you is my wife's pain issues. And DMSO and aloe vera helps to some extent, but she had a heart attack in early 2015, and I've always wanted her to take omega-3s for the wonderful health benefits. But when you get involved with one area of the body, then that seems to be the only thing they're interested in. So they said, well, we're taking her off of omega-3s, putting on Plavix for a year. Well, it's been 5 years now. And they're still saying, well, hey, you know, don't mess with it if it's working. Well, it may work for blood thinning, but I want her to get all the other benefits from a quality omega-3. So I'm still, after 5 years, trying to get them to allow that. I've read in books on how it doesn't cause stomach bleeds, and they did take her off a couple months after her heart attack. They took her off the aspirin because she did have emergency room visits with stomach bleed. So that's where we're at this point. But I'm still frustrated that I haven't been able to get the doctors to allow the omega-3 back into her body.
Do the doctors object to her eating fish?
Well, she kind of objects to that, but she does make sure we, you know, are allowed to get some trout or salmon or something.
You missed the point here. Dr. Mixon was trying to make a point.
Yeah, I'm trying. Maybe I was a little too circumspect.
Yes, right.
That was a great point, but my point was important too, because, you know.
Yes. If she doesn't like fish, don't eat fish. But my point is that if the doctor doesn't object to her eating fish, then the doctor should have no objection to her taking omega-3 capsules, because it's the same thing.
Thank you so much. That really helps. I'm sorry, I should have let you go ahead.
So if they haven't said, well, we don't want you eating any fish, fine. But if they're going to let you eat fish, and you can take the pill too.
Well, lots of doctors get so protective of what they tell you to do, what they put you on, they don't like it if you do anything else, quite frankly. Yeah.
Well, and often. also you can increase your omega-3 levels so high that you increase LDL formation, which if you've got cardiovascular disease, you don't want elevated LDL.
That's right.
The FDA says up to 3,000 milligrams a day of omega-3s is safe. If you exceed 3,000 milligrams a day of omega-3s, then you have a statistically significant risk of raising your LDL levels. Okay. So, you know, if you're down at 1,000 or 2,000 milligrams a day, you're well within the safety factor. And, you know, I wouldn't get terribly excited.
I'm trying to help her get some exercise, and one thing she loves is gardening and those things. But now, since she has all this pain through her body 24 hours a day anyway, that just adds to sore muscles. And I'm wondering if some D-ribose in her bloodstream would help get into those sore muscles and help alleviate that.
It might. I know Dr. Sinatra likes D-ribose.
Mm-hmm.
I have not used it much myself, so I don't have personal experience. But, you know, Sinatra says it's great stuff. So, who knows?
Okay. Okay, well, I thank you all, and you have so many wonderful topics. It's just a fabulous, fabulous show.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, David. Nice of you to say that. Appreciate it. And it's time for a break. We will be back, I think, we do have Sue and Lillian with their questions. I think we can take one or two more. So call us with your questions at 1-888-312-5757. 1-888-312-5757. Don't go too far. We'll be back.
They called you about the health analysis that I took a year ago. I went to the Linwood office, and I must tell you, your staff is so amazing. At Longevity, they talk to you. They make you understand what's going on, and they give you the numbers so you have a starting point. And that's what I love about coming to you guys.
Sugar pie, honey, dance.
Yes, absolutely.
She gets those wrists going and the bangles will go jingling and jangling.
You know, in the Indian dance, the funny thing is they say it's like changing the light bulb. That's what
right.
you're doing
yes,
with your
yes,
hands.
Yes.
Changing
well, you know,
the light bulb.
That's the whole story. How many surgeons does it take to change a light bulb?
Yeah.
Only one. He simply holds the bulb in the air and the earth revolves around him.
That's funny.
How many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb?
I don't know. How many?
Only one, but it takes 5 years, and the bulb has to really want to change.
That's funny.
You see what I have to put up with? Yes. They're dancing, telling jokes, and I try to be so serious. You know, I'm a serious guy. I think we need to...
For moments at a time.
For yes. moments at a time. I tell you. I love my Saturday mornings. Let us go to Kirkland and talk with Sue. Sue, we're glad you called.
Yes. Excuse me. I'm calling to ask, you were mentioning the garlic breath associated with the use of DMSO.
Yes.
And I have heard other times that chewing parsley will nullify a lot of the effects of the garlic.
Or the chlorophyll-containing gums. Yeah, the chlorophyll lozenges and gums will sometimes help, too. They at least mask it nicely. Yeah.
Masking it, yeah.
And sure. I was just wondering if that would work with the DMSO also.
Probably, but I don't really know. I've never tried it.
No, I mean, I haven't tried it either. I'm not taking DMSO, but I was just thinking I'd heard that.
Well, you know, it might. It would be an interesting interesting to find out. So some of you folks out there, because I know we have listeners that are using DMSO. We've had several callers today. A, are you noticing the garlic breath that is reported? And B, if you are, have you used a chlorophyll gum or parsley or something to mask it? And if so, call and let us know, because this is something that Dr. Umat and I don't know about.
That's interesting. I think this is the first time you've given them homework.
I have, yes.
This is a new era.
Well, you know, sometimes I call for doctors to call in.
Yes,
you know,
you
I'll
do.
Say, this is a, I need a specialist, and sometimes doctors call.
Yeah.
But this would be a one of you guys out there that are using DMSO. Call and let us know.
We'll Very good. We're turning the tables.
Okay, yeah. I don't know.
Right. Anything else, Sue?
Well, I did have a question about heating pads.
Uh-huh.
And I've heard people say also that whenever you use electrical appliances, you can get EMFs,
mm-hmm.
electromagnetic magnetic forces.
Sure. Yeah, you get EMF fields anytime you're using any electrical appliance, and especially if you're mm-hmm. using the old-fashioned electric blankets or
I was going to
you know,
I was
pads.
Raised I used one my whole
Yeah, that's what life. Happened.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking about Dr. Sinatra. He's so opposed to all those electromagnetic
yes.
fields. I heard him or somebody mention that if you go to do a seminar with him, they actually have you leave the phones in a separate room. And
yeah.
they do earth things. You know, you walk on ground. You walk on soil, actually, to get the grounding from the earth. Because there's electrical current. I mean, your heart has electrical current in it. So
sure.
so they talk a lot about holistic
and
medicine.
I try
yeah.
to keep my brain with the little impulses moving,
go.
Too. Yes. I don't want to ground it.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, you're right. The Sinatra lectures can be interesting.
Yes.
but no, yes, you will have electric fields. The question is, to what extent do you believe those electromagnetic fields are impacting your health and welfare? And, you know, there is a wide variety of opinion. And I've got a couple of my doctors, my naturopathic type docs that are seriously opposed to electromagnetic fields.
Sure.
They try to see to it the cell phones and so on are in the other room at night when they're charging, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I've never especially worried about it. I've heard the lectures, and I said, I'm not giving up my phone.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. What about, I was more interested in relation to electrical appliances you put directly on the body,
sure.
like heating pads or electric blankets.
Yeah. Well, and that would obviously,
your tape on it.
Well, that would obviously add the highest intensity of the fields. So yes, if you're using heating pads or electric blankets, you are just bathing yourself in electromagnetic fields. Whether it seriously does you harm or not, I have no idea. You know, I know that some doctors like Dr. Sinatra would consider it anathema. You know, he would mm-hmm. spit, swear, and throw things rather than use it. But
mm-hmm.
personally, I just don't like the kind of heat I get with an electric blanket. Haven't used one since I was a very small child.
Yeah, me neither.
I do like a great big fuzzy comforter.
Appreciate the call, Sue.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Appreciate
the call, man.
Let us go to Bremerton and talk with Lillian. Lillian, welcome to the show.
Hi. My speech isn't too clear. I may have had a stroke some years ago, but I'm not aware of it. But let me tell you what happened to me. Last October, I fell and cracked a bone in my knee. Because of my age, the doctor said he would not put on a heavy cast. And he wanted me to go to bed for 3 weeks, and so I did. And they put a brace on my leg from my ankle up to my hip with a steel rod up going up the length of it to keep me from bending my knee.
Uh-huh.
I was down for about 3.5 months, and about 3 weeks to a month after I got out, I started getting these itchy spots on me. I was itching all over, on my shoulders and my my arm and my leg and my back. I itch. I wonder if there's something I'm taking, or my medication is pretty much the same as I always took, so I don't know.
That's a good question. All right, for those of you that might have had some difficulty understanding, this lady obviously is seriously elderly. She fell. She injured her knee. They didn't want to put her in a heavy cast because of her age and disability, so they used a brace from the ankle to the hip with a metal rod to stabilize things. She's been down now for a couple of months and has developed itching over much of her body. So the question is, she'd like to know why.
Mm.
And I'm not sure. Reality is, older people get dry, itchy skin very easily. It could have simply been the prolonged contact with the sheets and or a fabric softener or a detergent in the sheets that she would react to. Not likely to be one of the medical devices that were on the brace, although I guess it could be. I don't know if there were plastic fasteners or leather fasteners or what was there. Sometimes these braces will have a sheepskin inner collar, and some people, the sheepskin will irritate and cause allergies. And, you know, she said, was it to your medicines? But, of course, she didn't tell us what the medicines were.
Right.
So
yeah,
we're kind of at a loss for that one, too. Real world with your problems, young lady, is to sit down with your primary care doctor, and you're going to have to end up going through an elimination series. They're going to have to kind of make a list of all the things you're exposed to that could be triggering this sort of reaction, and then one at a time go and eliminate them until you find the one that you're reacting to. And it is going to be a problem. In the meantime, I'd be very, very cautious about how you wash. Make sure that your skin is very dry before you put the brace or anything back on. Try not to use soaps. Just use water and rinse as much as you can. There's an old saying that says, keep aged skin oiled, wash only when soiled. Because aged skin needs to keep an oil barrier or it will dry and really itch badly. And so you don't want to wash it very often, and you don't want to use soaps and detergent unless you really have to. So I guess that's about the best I can offer, given the little bit of information we've got on causes. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Samira?
No, just medications, which we don't know. So, yeah. And you mentioned that already. So,
okay. Sorry, we can't be of more help, Lillian.
Yeah.
That is a shame. So, boy. That's frustrating when we can't just say, do exactly this. Yeah. Here's the solution.
We just don't have enough information to know what the problem is.
Thank you for your call, however, Lillian. Okay, our last break of the day. When we come back, we'll talk with Kay from Olympia, a question about low iron levels, and then we have room for one more call. So why don't you give us a call with your health question? Maybe you need a second opinion. Well, wow. This is your chance to do that at 1-888-312-5757. 1-888-312-5757. Give us a call.
The night was clear and the moon was yellow and the leaves came tumbling down. I was standing on the corner when I heard my bulldog bark. He was barking at the two men who were gambling in the dark.
10 minutes before the noon hour. I didn't mean to scare you. Sorry. She jumped.
We were talking about robin eggs. That was
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
10 minutes. I'll say it softly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There you
go. Yeah, little robin has laid eggs in our backyard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she built a nest, and I had to learn a lot about robins because we saw this robin's nest, bird making a nest, but then at night the bird was never there.
Huh.
And we had to go to Dr. Google, of course, who answered, did you know robins don't sleep in their nest? It's not a bed. It's an incubator.
Okay.
They build the nest. They actually sleep with a whole host of other robins. They get together as a flock, and they sleep in a tree or in bushes or something. They never sleep in their nests. And the only purpose for the nest is they build the nest. They lay the eggs. They lay the first egg, and then they'll come back and lay it the second day. Once they've laid at least two eggs, then they'll sit on the nest.
Huh.
But they only sit on the nest for 10 to 12 days till the birds hatch.
Okay.
Then they come back periodically. They feed the babies until they fledge. At about 2 weeks, they hop out of the nest and learn to fly. But they never, ever sleep in their nest. Those bird nests are not for birds to sleep. So the cartoons are wrong. The birds don't live in their nests.
I did not know that.
Incubators for babies.
I did not.
No.
See? Isn't that interesting?
It is. It is.
A beautiful blue little robin eggs.
Eggs look gorgeous.
Ivory is enjoying that process.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
That's good.
She sits out on her deck and she peers up into to see if she can see the mommy bird sitting on the nest.
Yeah. Cool.
All right. Let us go to Kay in Olympia. Kay, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hello.
I have a question. My husband has very high hematocrit and has to give blood every 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. But this last time he went in, his iron levels were very high and they would not accept his blood. So they sent him home and told him to come back in another 6 weeks. Now, my question is, how do you lower iron?
You give blood.
That's how you lower iron. I saw your look on your face.
Yeah, I don't know where they expect the iron's going to go.
I don't either. If it stores in the liver, it seems like it would increase.
Yes, it does. And, you know, what you need to do is you need to pull off the blood, which will then cause the iron to come out of the liver to make new blood. And then you pull off that and you pull more iron out of the liver. And so people that have this condition, that we call it hemochromatosis, often need to donate blood, you know, a couple of times a month even to keep their iron stores in normal non-toxic range.
If the levels were high,
they won't take it.
So does he have to get a phlebotomist on his own and pay to have it pulled off then?
He will have to pay to have it pulled off. Used to be that if you had a prescription from the doctor saying that you needed a therapeutic phlebotomy, the blood banks would still draw the blood. They would just charge you for it. And I don't remember what the fee was, but it was significant. I mean, it was $100 or some such thing. Once your blood level dropped low enough, then you could just donate blood again. And you're able to donate your blood until that hematocrit gets up into the low 50s, 51, 52, maybe 53. At that point, they won't draw it anymore, which is kind of bizarre. And now, a few months ago, most of the blood banks stopped doing therapeutic phlebotomies, which is kind of strange. So, yeah, in fact, we've now been talking with our biological disposal company about being able to do the phlebotomies for our own patients, because some of our men that are on testosterone supplementation will raise their hematocrit too high. And now that we can't send them to the blood bank, we're trying to make arrangements to be able to do it ourselves. But once more, that's only for our people. I don't know what they're thinking, ma'am. It makes no sense to me.
Well, after listening to you today, I'm going, this doesn't make any sense at all. If the only way you can take it off is by a blood draw.
Yeah, that is certainly the most efficient, and that's what has been done for a couple of generations, ever since this condition was first discovered. It's the easiest, healthiest, you know, least traumatic way of lowering your blood count. All the other stuff you're talking about are, you know, things that are actually interfering with bone marrow production, and that's not good. So, yeah, this is the simple way.
Okay.
That's all.
Well, all right. I appreciate your input. Thank you.
Okay, thank you,
Kay. Let's quickly go to Cece in Seattle. Cece, welcome.
Ooh, Cece Ryder, is that book about you? Or the song about you, the Cece Ryder?
Song I don't like.
Oh, sorry about that. I loved it, but let's not go there.
Okay.
Thank you, Cece.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I'm calling about if anyone heard about the infrared bulb that you need a bendable lamp that sits from the floor. And, well, the use on human beings. I was raised on it whenever we had a cold. My dad put us on the bed, lying with on our back exposed, and he put the bulb on it, the infrared bulb, and then he set it right in the middle between the shoulder blades, and leave it. Then put an army blanket over us, and then focus the bulb there. And he leave it on for 20 minutes, and then he take it off, and then when we wake up, everything comes flying out, like all the mucus and everything, all the gunk.
So
I was kind of curious if anyone knew of the use of the infrared bulb on humans.
No, and I haven't.
That was the last time I ever used it. I was 13 years old, and I came down with a bad cold, and he did that. And now I'm a healthy one. I'm now going in my 70s.
Well, you know, think about it. If it's increasing heat and it's increasing vasodilatation and increasing blood flow, then it could help. It could help with pain. I could understand that. Remember nowadays people are talking.
Everything came flying out.
Sure.
I mean, I didn't have to hack the cough or anything. It just flew out.
No, I mean, it doesn't sound unreasonable. We can, you know, we're sitting here. Neither one of us have ever done it or really heard of it. But it's not an unreasonable approach.
To naturopath doctors, and they have the way up in the ceiling, the infrared bulb. And every time I go there, I laugh. I said, "Now, what is that supposed to do way up in the ceiling?"
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious here. You know, I don't want to tell anyone anything on what I experienced, because then there's a lot of, you know, in life, there's a lot of, I don't know, you know, you try to say something good, but then they take it the other way, and, you know,
sure.
I go through walks of life all my life like that, so I adjust to it, you know, I just leave it as it is.
Sure. Well, I mean, it actually sounds like a very nice idea. I used to have a girlfriend from Hawaii. She was talking about when she was a teenage girl and would have problems, you know, colds and rest. They'd send her down to the beach, and they'd lay on the beach in the sunshine and breathe the salt, the moist salt air, and let the sun bake it out of them, sort of thing. Mm. Which is kind of similar. It's this is infrared from the sun as opposed to a bulb.
Yeah.
With that, I'm afraid we are running out of time. We have less than a minute to go. But Cece, thank you for your call.
Yep.
Good call. Yep. Always interesting calls.
My grandmother for colds would do a tablespoon of a moonshine whiskey and honey.
That's what I was going to say. Brandy will fix anything.
That's right. A little moonshine and honey, it fixed anything and everything.
How about that? Folks, thank you so much on this Father's Day weekend for being with us. We do this because it's downright exciting to see what happens with people that become patients at Longevity. Don't forget, we're making available, and we've opened up. Bia sent me an email again yesterday saying that she's opened up through July 24th. So if you would like to grab one of our free health analysis appointments and get the two free tests and the $100 of longevity supplements, also absolutely free, well, then you go to our website at lmclinic.com. lmclinic.com. Push the tab that says health analysis appointment and schedule your free appointment. You're going to have to wait probably until the second or third week of July. But that's okay. If you don't schedule today,
you may be
in
August.
Next week, you're probably going to have to wait till August. So don't do that. Make your free health analysis appointment. Get the two free tests, the $100 of longevity supplements, also absolutely free. And could be the smartest thing you do in a long time.
Happy Father's Day weekend, guys.